Hello, and welcome to the Vicar's Watch Dibley,
the podcast where real priests talk about pop culture and what we've learnt about faith, life and the church. We've watched Dibley, now we're watching everything else. I'm Kate.
I'm Ross.
And I'm Ruthie. And today we are talking about Fleabag and Hot Priest and everything that's related to series two of Fleabag. We talk quite a lot about boundaries and the importance of that, and loneliness. And there's a bit of a trigger warning for this episode that actually some of the things that happen aren't great, and just to be mindful and careful of yourself. Our vicarages, and you're listening in, and we're ready and raring to talk about Fleabag finally. But first, we have some notices. Ross, what's going on in your life?
In my life, well, so at the time of recording, I am in my first week having finished public worship for my church as a vicar. So even though I'm technically going to be the vicar of this parish until my licensing in March, I've kind of finished pretty much all of my vicar duties, which is quite a weird feeling, really.
Yeah. Have you got a move date yet?
No, not yet. I know it'll be towards the end of February. I saw the house earlier this week, and that's very exciting.
You've got quite a long break then, haven't you, between jobs?
It was a decision that was made with the church wardens of the parish here, looking at various things coming and going in the church diary. I've got a couple of weeks now, then I am doing general synod because I'll still be licensed to Oxford Diocese for that, and then I'll probably be moving house and
It's all going, Rossland. So what are you going to do in your kind of downtime? What are good things for vicars to do between jobs?
Well, a retreat is usually recommended.
Yeah.
So once I've moved house, I'll probably look to find somewhere more local to Salisbury to go on a retreat. If anybody knows anywhere in the Wiltshire area, do let us know. I'm just trying to take some chill time, really. I'm sorting through all of my stuff because I'm going to have to downsize a little bit. Just work out what I'm keeping, what I'm getting rid of, all that sort of stuff.
So. We should also add to our notices. Okay, Ben, I'm just doing some recording right now. Could you go back downstairs with Mama?
Okay.
Mooncakes outside the door, yeah. Yeah. So I guess the notice I need to give is that it's a snow day here. And so my son would normally be at a nursery, but it's shut because there is an impending blizzard that is supposed to be coming. And it's one of those days where it's like, oh, it would have been really helpful for Ben to be at nursery today, but he is not. And also, I've got a burial this afternoon at the time that there's supposed to be a blizzard. So this is going to be really interesting.
What a convergence of pressures.
Oh, all the things all at once. It's great. And I guess the notice from you, Kate, is that you're not feeling great.
Yeah, I've got the onset of a migraine. So if I'm a bit quieter, I've got my volume turned down quite low. To just be gentle on my ears and my head. But we'll see how we go.
Are you suggesting I'm quite a loud laugher and a bit noisy, Kate? Because you would be correct. So with this episode, we're going to talk about Fleabag, which is a really interesting series. And loads of you have asked if we're going to talk about Fleabag. And when Ross joined, it was one of the first things that he said he wanted to talk about. Mm. And so we're finally getting there. Now, Ross, tell us a bit about Fleabag.
So Fleabag was originally a stage play, a one-person play that was written and acted by Phoebe Waller-Bridge. That was sort of in the mid-2010s. And then it was commissioned for TV. And in 2016, season one came out. And when it came out, it sort of passed me by completely. I had no idea that it was even around. Season two was released in 2019. And I think it picked up a lot more viewers. I think a lot of people went back to watch it again. It created a bit of a conversation online about life, about relationships, but also I think about the church and faith, because of a character who was added in season two, the priest, played by Andrew Scott, who is in all sorts of stuff at the moment. I mean, very familiar actors in this series.
Yeah. I mean, Olivia Colman's in it.
Olivia Colman is the godmother. Yep, absolutely. Yes. And she's amazing in it as well. She's playing a character really against her usual type.
Oh, yeah. She's not a nice character. It's the godmother.
Not at all.
But it became a bit of a big thing, didn't it? Because of the priest. And this is why we are interested in it in many ways. We've focused on season two, but it's a series that's all about grief in so many different ways, isn't it? Both of them. But like, I had the Vicar of Dibley book. You have the Fleabag.
I have Fleabag book. The Scriptures, which has season one and season two in it. I've also got the original stage play somewhere. That's fun to read. Yeah, so it's been really interesting sort of for me. I think I've been thinking about it particularly because of a scene in episode four of season two. And that created a huge amount of discussion when it was first released. We meet...
Yes.
Well, yeah.
It was the point that I stopped watching.
Sure.
Because I'd watched... let's just talk a bit about our kind of initial reactions to it, because clearly, Ross, you're a bit of a fan with the scripts and things like that. And I really enjoyed season one and season two, and then I stopped watching after episode four that we're going to do a lot of discussing about today because of what happens in it. So I was kind of vaguely aware of the ending of some of it, because I'm a person on the internet and seen videos and things like that. But I didn't know the full extent of the ending. So I forced myself to rewatch episode four and then finish five and six last night. So it's fresh in my mind to talk about. But Kate, you hadn't watched it before, had you?
No. It's just not something that's ever really clicked with me, wanting to watch it.
Fair enough.
I appreciate it as an important work. It's award-winning, and I understand why. It's just not something I particularly want to watch. A bit like the kind of Alan Bennett Talking Heads thing. It's that kind of expression of the kind of... Yeah, but there's just something about it. It just makes me think, remember, I don't know, like having to write essays in GCSE. I don't know. It's just not the type of comedy that I enjoy watching. It's like I didn't watch Rev either. I'm just not interested in it.
Shocking. I feel like you need to go in the confessional for that. Oh, relevant.
I think it's interesting you mentioned Alan Bennett, because in many ways I think, you know, that there is something that Fleabag does, which is captures something of real life, the poignancy of the mundane, I guess, of real life. But then it's also got, on the other side, sort of the goofiness of the sitcom Miranda, you've got these bits, so similar to the way that Miranda Hart would engage with the audience by looking to the camera and making comments. The protagonist character, who we shall from here on call Fleabag, we actually know her real name, Fleabag also turns to the camera and has a relationship with the audience. But there's a different kind of a nuance going on there to the one with Miranda. So, it's a really interesting show.
I enjoy her turns to the camera. And it's one of the things the priest picks up on in this, that he notices she's doing something like that. And it's fascinating. So
yeah, it reminded me a lot of the final episode of My Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, where all through the show she kind of has these musical fantasies of musicals and songs which are kind of related to what's happening in her life. And in the last episode, spoiler alert, we see the other side of her friends watching her kind of zone out. And you realise that this is actually something she's doing. It's not a fantasy. This is something that's kind of, she's just zoning out and this is happening in her head, and she might be mumbling the song under her breath. I think it's a really interesting idea of kind of exploring mental illness through kind of a breaking of the fourth wall. We should watch My Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, because there's a priest in that as well.
Oh, okay. Yeah. There we go. Add it to the list.
Yeah. So, Ross, do you want to give us a kind of brief overview of series two? Would that be helpful?
I'll give you a breakdown of season two. In episode one, there is it's basically all set in a restaurant over a family dinner. It's a fairly uncommunicative family dynamic, and some of the characters haven't seen each other for quite a long time, and they're reconnecting. But also there is a priest, their cool sweary priest, as Fleabag says,
a Catholic priest as well, which I think is important priest, to most.
And he's going to be marrying Fleabag's father and their new stepmother, who is their godmother from back in the day. Their mother has died, and that grief is something that is carried through, especially season one, but is also present in this season as well. One of the interesting things, I think, in episode one, is that one of the characters asks the priest, "Do you usually come out for dinner with the couples you're going to marry?" And he says, "No, but I'm lonely." Or words to those effect. And when I was doing a rewatch the other day, I noticed that in terms of, that is kind of set up from the very beginning. And there's a bit where Fleabag says, "No one's asked me a question," to the camera, "no one's asked me a question in 40 minutes. And in that moment, he turns and asks her a question. So in episode one of season two, we get this sense that actually there is something about the priest noticing Fleabag. And over the course of episodes two and three, they meet up, and she goes along to church, and we see that, you know, she finds him attractive. He's getting blustered and a bit flustered where in her presence, but generally everything is kept all above board and on a sort of platonic banter level.
And she doesn't believe in God. She's not particularly interested in faith and all things. It's a bit of a silly thing to be involved in.
And there are some fabulous gags where she says, you know, there's a little conversation. "I'm a normal person." "A normal person? What's a normal person?" the priest replies, and Fleabag says, "Well, I don't believe in God." And then a picture frame of Jesus falls down in the vestry.
I love that bit,
And then the priest says, "I love it when he does that."
Great line.
So there's a really fun banter between them, and I think there is something sort of genuine about the way that the priest has found someone that he connects with, not someone that he wants to try to convert or necessarily bring into the Christian fold, but someone that he kind of is enjoying doing life with. This all comes to a head in episode four, where they meet after hours by accident in the church, and She's gone there to pray. She was on the verge of a little prayer, I think is the phrase that she says. But she hears the priest playing music in the vestry. He's been drinking. They talk, and she's trying to express something that is sitting deep within her soul. And he suggests, he suggests something. He takes her out to the confessional. She sits in there, him in the other side. And she has this, I think it's a really beautiful monologue. Maybe later on I'll read it out. But there's a deep human vulnerability there. Where she sort of says she just wants someone to tell her what to do. There's a long pause. And then he tells her to kneel.
When I watched it the first time, I thought, because she's kind of going on this spiritual journey, like she goes to a Quaker meeting and stuff with him, and he finds it a bit weird, but kind of engages with it as well. And she's like, she's pouring out her soul at this point in the confessional, and is doing this. And when I first watched it, when he says kneel, I thought, oh, wow, there's going to be a real kind of spiritual moment for her here.
Yeah.
And the confessional in the Catholic, Roman Catholic understanding is very sacred space and very holy space and a chance for people to seek forgiveness from God and all this stuff. And he says, kneel. And I'm like, oh, gosh, wow, amazing. What's going to happen here? And then what happens, Ross?
Well, then the door to the confessional opens and... to some extent, trigger warning. I think we should probably have a trigger warning at the beginning of this episode for people who may be affected by things like this. And the priest is sort of standing over her. And the pair of them then begin to kiss in the confessional itself, but out, you know, in the body of the church.
No, they do both. They're in the confessional.
But are they in the confessional? I thought it was outside the confessional.
They start in the confessional.
Okay.
Yeah, and move outside into the body of the church.
As things are developing and to some extent heating up, suddenly, as in the vestry in one of the earlier episodes, a picture falls off the wall in the church, making a loud bang. And that is the impetus that drives the priest away and back to the vestry. And that's kind of how I think that episode ended, I think.
Doesn't he tell her as well? I can't remember properly. Maybe you can check, Ross. Doesn't he tell her to never come into his church again? Or words like that?
That's in the next episode.
Is that the next episode?
They meet up again and he says in episode 5, don't go back to church again. And I think that's interesting. I think that's almost a whole other... part of what I'm interested in terms of their dynamic and in terms of how he is trying to look after both himself and Fleabag in the long term. But what's interesting is that I think I was really interested in the impact that this scene had on Twitter and especially Anglican Twitter. A lot of talk about safeguarding and abuse and the maintenance of good boundaries and that kind of thing. And the fact that there is, you know, there is a power dynamic at play between the priest and Fleabag that that is not okay. But I felt that there was a nuance that was being overlooked, which is the sheer loneliness of the priest. And the things that led him to that situation. So that's kind of where I'm coming from. I'm interested in Fleabag and clergy loneliness, or just human loneliness.
Yeah, I mean, I must admit, watching this one single episode in isolation, what struck me was that at the beginning, you saw Fleabag. She had a lot of the power in their dynamic. Or she was wanting vulnerability from him, but refusing to disclose her own vulnerability. And actually, when he tried to push her on that, she punished him in a way by kind of forcing him to leave. And then when she did open up to become vulnerable, the power dynamic shifted.
Yeah.
And he did he acted precisely wrongly. But you can sort of see how, you know, he was self-medicating, and he was not in a place at all to be receiving the sacrament. If you in the Catholic tradition, confessional is a sacrament. So you shouldn't be going into it drunk. And if you're Sozzled. Receiving confession, you should actually, you know, have your own sort of moment, time for confession and preparation before you as a priest go into the confessional booth. And you are meant to not, you are not meant to have your own character in the confessional booth. You, there's a reason that you are not seen. You are, the person on the other side isn't meant to be thinking of you as you. You are instead a representative or conduit of God. That's really poorly explained, but you are, it's not about you as a person. There's a, there's a purpose of anonymity on both sides. So yeah, it was, there was really interesting shift there. Whereas to begin with, I felt that she was pushing him in ways that were unhealthy for both of them, of really, you know, she wasn't taking his faith seriously and wasn't really taking perhaps his vows for celibacy seriously, but also wanting the vulnerability from him but not wanting to give vulnerability in exchange. And then that shifted when she was vulnerable, and huge safeguarding nightmare. Or just dynamics in any relationship was really unhealthy.
Well, it starts off as that sort of friend, as sort of a friendship of two people with souls that that kind of bump into each other and find some level of attraction, or at least the ability to get on with one another. And at first, Fleabag, I think, feels like it's an unreciprocated love that she has for him.
But I don't think it's love in the beginning, though. I definitely think it's lust, but it turns to love.
Yeah, yeah. And but she goes along to church, and she's sort of drawn in. But then we learn that he is falling for her, and for him, when the later on in the series where sex becomes a question, he's aware that he doesn't want to have sex with her because he doesn't want to fall in love with her. Because of his love for God and church.
Because actually we do see that. We see his excitement over his calling. You know, his excitement over trying on the vestments and and going to a Quaker meeting. And all the time while he's sharing this excitement, she's giving us the fourth wall break, saying, oh, his arms, his neck, his beautiful neck.
I wonder what he's thinking.
She's not listening to him. But it reminded me, in a way, it almost reminded me of when I have kind of been flirting with someone and I feel like it's been going well, and then suddenly it becomes pastoral. Where suddenly they are wanting to have those pastoral conversations with you. And for me, that's a moment of suddenly like, oh, I'm sorry, I can't. This can't be a flirty thing anymore because this dynamic doesn't work for me. It's interesting. That's just something, again, that's another reason why I find it really difficult to watch this. It just touches too many little raw points, I guess.
Well, it's been interesting, I think, for me as an LGBT plus chaplain, which is a role that the Diocese of Oxford has, and which I'm going to be sort of finishing up soon, really. But you know, during that, I have met with other gay men who have wanted to talk about faith and church and God and how that negotiates space with their sexuality. And the pastoral nature of that relationship means that, okay, well, even if I find you quite attractive or even if I'm really enjoying your company, actually, there's a boundary here.
Yeah.
And that's a really important boundary. Sometimes it kind of goes unspoken. Sometimes it needs to be said. This is what this is.
Yeah.
This is what this relationship is. And you need to not get any ideas about it being anything else.
Yeah. I wonder if it's worth going through kind of what happens in the rest of the series and then kind of coming back to this. Because he tries to, you know, after this incident that happens in the confessional, he tries to place some boundaries in the kind of relationship, doesn't he? Because he goes to the house of Fleabag's dad and godmother and says that he can't do their wedding anymore because something's come up. And various things like that. Like, he tries to make that distance because he knows he's stepped over the line, but doesn't always do it in a successful way. So, Ross, do you want to take us through the rest of the series and what happens?
Yeah, so episode 5 opens with basically the priest being at the father and godmother's house and cancelling his involvement in their wedding. But then later on the episode, he meets with Fleabag, and he says, "Please don't come to the church again. I mean that with the greatest of compliments." And then he goes. But then at the end of episode 5, he comes to her flat. I think he just turns up. I don't think he's not invited, but
no.
he gets her address from her sister because she's expecting a hookup from a lawyer character, who she ends up turning away. But she is dressed ready for this hookup, so she's got a coat over lingerie. anyway, they have this this conversation, which ends with them having sex. And that's the end of episode 5. Episode 6 begins sort of that morning with them in bed, but it's also the day of the wedding. They get a cheeky kiss before the wedding begins and that kind of thing. But and then he's got a very... again, this was something that hit Anglican Twitter, his sermon at the wedding, which is in their back garden, and I don't know how allowed that is.
I did wonder that.
But the wedding's in the back garden of the house. He makes a really interesting speech about love being awful. And then at the very end, they have this exchange at a bus stop. The priest approaches and joins her, and she says, "You nailed it," presumably about the wedding. Mm. And then Fleabag says, "It's God, isn't it?"
Mm.
And the priest says, "Yeah." And then Fleabag says, "You know, the worst thing is that I love you."
Yeah.
And she says it a couple of times. And then he says, he takes her hand and gently says, "It'll pass." And she smiles, and then he walks because the bus isn't coming, and there's a whole joke around that. She says, he says, "See you Sunday." She laughs, and he says, "I'm joking. You're never, ever allowed in my church again." And then he says, "I love you too." "Okay." And he walks away.
Yeah.
So that's kind of how that sort of that relationship is brought full circle to two characters who came together and then move away from each other again at the end.
And from that conversation, she stops doing her fourth wall thing, doesn't she? She kind of has used it to divert herself from her grief and things that have gone on, because her best friend dies, and as well as her mum, and all of this stuff is just a mess. That's the kind of final moment that she's... she turns back to the camera and just shakes her head and then carries on walking without the camera following her. So I had seen that scene online, the kind of conversation of the bus with the priest and Fleabag in the bus stop. But I didn't know until I watched 4, 5, 6 that they'd had sex. I had no idea that had happened. It's a really funny, funny situation. Well, not funny, haha, but like difficult situation, because you get the loneliness, and there is this dynamic that we've, you know, if he was an Anglican priest, it wouldn't be as complicated as it is for him, because he's a Catholic priest, he's sworn to celibacy, and actually it's a bigger jump to leave the church, leave priesthood and all of that. Whereas
change denominations, which
yeah,
it is easy to say, oh, he could just become an Anglican vicar instead. Mm. That is such a hard decision to make.
Well, I was thinking about that. I'm thinking, you know, if something like this happened to me, would I switch denominations to go into a place that feels that would be more comfortable or allow me to pursue this? And I think there would be some that would be easier to switch to. Mm. So switch is a horrible word to say, really. It sounds like you just kind of like swap in and like, oh, switch to this day. But actually, I think it's...
Because there are some traditions, some denominations which are quite close together. So I would say Anglicanism and Methodism, although have some very key differences... I've worked with Methodists before. I've worked for Methodists before.
Oh, my congregation's full of Methodists.
and actually, there's lots of places where actually the Methodists will go to a Church of England church because there's no Methodist gathering. And we often, sometimes there'll be sharing of buildings. So there's a closer relationship there, but there are some very key differences, such as the different bishops in Methodism. And the structures are different as well for, you know, and I think there's good things about both Anglicanism and Methodism. But the difference with the Catholic Church, it is overwhelmingly different. As much as we can look quite similar sometimes, Anglicanism and Catholicism, actually there are some really big divides and differences. Not least, if Ruthie or I decided that we wanted to switch to Catholicism, we wouldn't be priests anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah,
we just wouldn't.
Yeah, yeah.
I have a small amusing anecdote that I went to Leeds the other day because the organist who is here at one of my churches, he's composed a piece of music. It was being played in Leeds Cathedral, so I went along to support him. I didn't realise that there isn't an Anglican Church of England Cathedral in Leeds. It's only the Catholic one. And so I popped along to Leeds Cathedral and they thought, oh, this must be the right place. And, you know, went in and sat down and was like, oh, there's a mass going on. Okay. Because it said mass outside. But actually, if you're in quite a high Anglican church, it might say mass. So I was like, oh, okay, I'll just sit down and look at, and you know, wait for the service to finish because then it's the music afterwards. And then I looked around and was like, quite a lot of pictures of the Pope for an Anglican cathedral. I thought, oh no, am I in the wrong building? But there isn't a cathedral for the Anglican Church, at least. I was in the correct place. I just, was a bit surprised by the Pope. And I was in my dog collar as well, so I was a bit like, oh, just zip up my coat at this point. So, yeah, it's a big change. And so... the character who is called the priest but becomes known as colloquially as Hot Priest for many people has this real wrestle with it all. Yeah. And it's interesting what you say about how Anglican Twitter, now known as X, responded to the things that happened in the confessional and everything else that Hot Priest does as part of it, because I feel like rest of the world Twitter who watched it actually, well, found it a bit sexy, shall we say. Everyone,
I think a lot of people did have that other kind of relationship with that scene for whatever particular itch that scratches.
Because I saw
trying to work out how to put that, really.
Yeah. A clip on Graham of Graham Norton the other day where he's interviewing Andrew Scott. Is talking about that scene where the priest says kneel and there's ladies on Twitter who are enjoying it immensely. whereas the reaction that we had to it was just like, no, stop. Nothing about this is sexy. It's all just so wrong. Mm. But there is the kind of, I think especially with Catholic priests, it's the sexy unobtainable, you know. Mm. He is a bit of a hot priest. They've got this flirtation going on, but he is forbidden fruit, for want of a better word.
But I don't think that's a part of what Fleabag is after.
No.
I mean, I think that's a lot of the public feeling towards hot priests or people who are deemed to be cassock chasers. but for me, I think Fleabag is drawn to the fact that he notices her, he's interested in her. He and they have this banter that does feel special and sparky.
Yeah.
And so I don't think she's in it for, you know, the fetish.
She does quite enjoy him trying on the robes, though, doesn't she?
I feel like that maybe not the fetish, but something about maybe the unobtainable. And can I... this person who loves God so much, can I become more important to this person? But then at the same time, I mean, there were boundaries he perhaps should have had in place a lot sooner in terms of their interactions and how and when they were meeting and how much time they were spending together. Not saying that you can't spend time alone with someone who you might be attracted to, and that will always be a dangerous situation. But there's definitely something to do with he was not helping himself with, you know, knowing that he was attracted to her, and protecting himself from getting too far into that attraction, and protecting her, like, knowing that it's not, if she falls in love with him, as we see at the end of Fleabag, at the end of the series, it can't go anywhere.
Yeah.
He makes that choice to go to her house in the evening. Yeah. You know, he knows where she works, so he could have gone there instead to the cafe, but he made that decision to find out where she lives and go and visit her there.
And not tell her that he was coming?
No.
Yeah, I think... So what we're coming up against here is that kind of clergy loneliness. Are clergy not allowed to make friends and have close friendships and intimate friendships that don't necessarily, you know, if you've taken a vow of celibacy, yeah, you're not allowed to have sexually intimate relationships. Does that mean that you can't have close friendships? Well,
It shouldn't preclude, you know, having a good... emotionally healthy friendship.
Yeah.
And actually, I imagine that this is what this started out for him. You know, he's new to the parish. He says at this meal that, you know, he hasn't got any friends. He finds somebody who he gets on with and who is interested in coming along to a Quaker meeting with him, and who, you know, comes along on a Sunday and helps out at the church fete kind of thing. So it starts off as that friendship, but then as it develops into something more, suddenly those boundaries become more complicated. And I think, he makes mistakes.
Yeah.
And I think there's something, and it's very easy as well to talk about he is single and he's celibate, but actually loneliness isn't a single person issue. And actually whenever loneliness does sort of take hold of a person, it can lead you to do to think poorly and to make misjudgments.
If you're lonely, you can very easily become over attached to anyone that you have a sort of a click with.
And because we are social animals, you know, we have emotions in play, you know, we have emotions that need, you know, that need looking after. Our emotional health is a part of who we are, as well as our mental health and physical health and spiritual health.
It's like The Sims. The Sims are social creatures, aren't they? And they get sad if they don't have friends to come over and play. And we're the same.
And even the most introvert of people. So I'm a hyper introvert. Yeah. Ruthie will know this. Ruthie's lived with me before. She knows I'm a hyper introvert. But I still need interaction with people. Yeah. Even if it's sitting in the same room and being quiet and doing different things.
Yeah. And going, Ruthie, stop talking. I just need to sit with you.
I just need to sit with you. There's something to do with when we apply for positions in the Church of England. One of the things we're often asked is about our support networks and who will be supporting us in ministry and who do we turn to when things are difficult. Because the expectation is that we won't be looking for those people in our parishes or our congregations or whatever our role is. And that we should have those healthy networks already established so that no matter what situation we find ourselves in, we still have people who support us. If you're single, that's a little bit harder because you don't, you know, naturally have a spouse who's there at the end of the day. But even if you are married, you still need those people outside of your spouse who are going to support you, because putting all that on one person is an awful lot. So we have things like cell groups where we have some trusted peers who will go to with the everyday things of ministry, up and downs, talking about how things are going, who we pray with, and those friendships as well, who we try to invest in long term.
Force them to be on a podcast with us so that they stay our friends.
Force them to be on a podcast with you so that we have to talk to you every 2 weeks.
Thanks, guys.
We are smart.
And because if you don't do that, and we're very lucky to live in the information era because we can do that over the internet. Even 10 years ago, that would have been really difficult.
Yeah. I think for the priest, his loneliness, his first coping mechanism isn't Fleabag.
No.
It's alcohol.
It is.
He's got gin and stuff hidden everywhere. I mean, before the confessional scene, he's hammered in the vestry looking for more booze. And so there's already warning signs for himself, if he's recognising them, if he's got other friends around, that actually he's not coping well where he is. Because moving to a new place is terrifying, and you have to create kind of new friendships, but also friendships that aren't too close at the same time. And I think I think me and Kate especially, living in villages, you know, you're always on show. Going to the pub for a quiet one here, well, it's never really a quiet one with me, to be honest, but you realize people know you as the vicar. So you can't like switch off properly, and you never know if someone's going to come up and go, oh, I've asked you about a baptism, and if you know, 4 pints in and feeling a bit merry, then that's not a good place to be. And so he deals with his loneliness with that, and then it kind of tumbles even more with this friendship that where they're undeniably attracted to each other, and it spirals out.
He's lonely, and I think it's exacerbated by being a young priest as well, because I imagine he has exactly the same experience that we do, where often you don't come into contact with people around your age that much. One of the reasons I love wedding prep so much, because it's the only time I spend significant time with people my own age. And it's quite nice having the same references, like cultural references, to be able to draw on. Whereas, I love everyone in my congregation. I love all the wonderful people I meet, but there is a generational divide of references and the things that we might watch on TV or, you know.
Yeah,
I found that as well. You know, as I have been finishing up my time as a vicar, the majority of my ministry in and around the parish has been with people who are my parents' or grandparents' age. And they've been a really, you know, it's been a good church, and actually in terms of in all sorts of ways, I could have felt a lot lonelier Because being a vicar, I think, is in essence a lonely job, partly because of what you're carrying spiritually, but also because you're the person at the top. You are the person with whom the buck stops. But even I would then, and in my first year, I focused really hard on trying to build up social networks outside of the parish, which is easier to do when you're in a town like Reading and your parish is but a part of it. But even when I was down at the gay pub, I became known as the vicar of the Blargrave. I was, and you know, somebody heard, oh, that's a vicar. So every now and again, someone would come up to me and to have a conversation. And as a priest, I'm absolutely there for them, to listen and to support. To be a priest is to occupy a different kind of social space with people, and our relationships are likely always going to be a bit different.
And
in some respects, on paper, from the initial meeting, Fleabag is actually a really sensible choice for to be a friend for the priest, because she's not a member of his congregation, and in fact she admits she doesn't have a faith. So
he likes
she's
that about
unlikely
her.
To be someone who is only ever going to talk about church with him, or is going to be so involved with his church work that it's not actually switching off and having fun with your friends. So on paper, that's actually, if I was looking to make friends, you know, in the village, that's the sort of person you're looking for, is someone who's on the periphery of your network, and is so is going to sort of understand what you do and what your the challenges of your life are, but isn't going to be so involved and insinuated in your work life that things get too messy in that way. Unfortunately, there is, you know, they both have their needs, which make them both vulnerable in that situation. And, you know, they're too attracted to each other to really perhaps be friends.
Yeah. I think all of this conversation, as well as, you know, with clergy loneliness, again highlights something that we've kind of talked a little bit about on the podcast before, about how the church teaches about sex and relationships and intimacy and all of this, and that, you know, I have experienced teaching that has massively damaged me, like in ways that I didn't realise until I was like, whoa, that's weird. And actually, and I don't think it was maliciously done, any of this, but actually there's so much of a shame culture that can be added to just your relationship and just your relationship with your body and everything like that. And that's something that the priest is wrestling with at the same time of wanting to be pals with.
And not even necessarily stuff that you're actively being taught. So I don't think anyone ever told me, oh, as a young woman, you can't be alone with a man or a young man in the same room. Like, oh, if you've got a male friend, you can't be alone
Christian
in the house
side
together.
Hug, baby.
and you can't hug them, or, you know, you can't get too close to them. I was never taught that, but I still, for like, ages, was always really awkward. Like, if I had a male friend coming over to like just watch a movie, I'd be like, oh, we've got to have the door open. Why on earth is that important? Like,
because you might get down to business, because your human urges might suddenly come out and go, oh, hello friend who's come over to watch Star Wars, now I feel very horny,
or to work on a university project.
That is hot.
Like, so yeah, there's that insidious kind of teaching, like, isn't even taught to you, it's just there because it's in the culture.
And it's making the assumption that everyone's straight. That, you know, you might have girls over and actually you're secretly a raging lesbian, and you know, that's all fine, shut the door and giggle, but you know, anyway.
I know, it's, yeah.
I was chatting with a student who, like the both of you, is a clergy kid. I think they're a double clergy kid. Anyway.
Like Ben.
Poor thing. and they were sort of carrying an awful lot of sort of inner turmoil around the whole sex before marriage thing. And eventually had a conversation with their parents about it. And the parents were like, when did we ever teach you that? And it was something that actually their parents didn't have that that theological expectation of their child. But some kind of culture had brought that out of them. Mm. And then interestingly, later on in the conversation, the student mentioned something else that their parents had said at some point about, oh no, you will need to sleep in separate rooms. It's like, well, that would probably help feed into that cultural expectation of, even if it's unintended or not actually part of the surface level conversation about sex or bodies or intimacy. Mm. It is something that is that is picked up. Mm. Yeah, I think the church's teaching on sex and bodies and intimacy is poor at the moment.
So we've talked a bit around the issues of boundaries and kind of might be what's going on in Hot Priest's head and maybe what's going on in Fleabag's head. Ross, you suggested that one thing we should talk about is what would we do?
Yeah, I think that, and another thought I've just had is, sorry, in that confessional scene, you only see Fleabag. You don't see the priest reacting. So you don't know what is going on in his head. You don't know if like what mode he's in. Because the way he's speaking sounds very much in confessional mode. But actually how he's reacting is different. But yeah, just thought about that. And yeah, what would we do?
Well, yeah, so I suppose in my head, this is kind of like a case, you know, I'm imagining it like as a case study.
Safeguarding that we might training get event.
Yeah. I mean, I think first thing I think I would note is that I don't drink on my own. And we do find the priest having been drinking alone. And I don't think that's a healthy activity by and large, just from the off.
Not just drinking alone, but drinking alone in a semi-public place. So if he was in his own home and drinking, not great, but he wouldn't have likely come into contact with anyone needing pastoral help. Or if they came, there would have been a way to screen.
So one thing actually, so this is a really interesting thing as well, actually, which you won't know, Kate, if you just watched episode 4. So he doesn't live alone. In the house where he lives with Pam, and Pam is somebody who worships at the church. I don't quite know what the situation is, but actually there is something about actually his home isn't his own in the same way. So that you've got a setup there for him drinking at the vestry, perhaps because he doesn't feel safe drinking or being himself and playing loud music alone at home. But you are quite right anyway that actually he's in a church doing this, but that also speaks into the fact that he's not able to do that.
I remember being told that at college about drinking alone is a bad idea. But actually, if you don't have a partner and, you know, you're not in a setup where it's easy to go to the pub or something like that, and actually you just fancy a glass of wine on your own at home watching a film or something like that, yes, there's no one else there going, oh, that's the second glass or that's your third bottle, maybe you should slow down. But that's a very hard thing to always have that as a rule, I would say.
Well, it's setting those boundaries of self-control. If you know that you are likely to always stop at one glass, for me, I don't particularly enjoy over drinking anyway. If I had a glass of gin and tonic and I was on my own, it would probably be just one. I don't particularly enjoy drinking unless I do have my friends with me, because then it's social and it's fun. But there are some people who don't have that level of self-control just because for whatever reason it's, you know, wandering leads to another for them. And to have that knowledge of yourself for any weakness, actually, or any inclination to say, actually, you know, it's time to stop. And if you can't do that, then you say, well, I need to avoid putting myself in the situation.
Actually, I'm only going to have a box of beer, like the four box of beer in the house at any one time.
Yeah. Or I'm not going to have loads and loads of chocolate.
Whatever it might be.
In the house. Like, let's go Vicar of Dibley here. I'm not going to have a fridge full of ice cream because I will eat the whole fridge.
Yeah.
You know?
So that's a good boundary to have in place.
Mm.
Someone that I have got this sort of deep attraction to and witty repartee comes into the vestry sort of after hours, and I think I would probably try to get it into more of a public space somehow. Mm. So that might be saying, oh, it's good to see you, how are you?
Yeah.
Shall we go for a walk?
Yeah.
Shall we go over the road where there's a cafe or a bar?
Mm.
And even if it's a bar and we are sharing a drink, it's in a public space. And I think it would be easier for me in a collar with someone else in a public space to be kind of like, okay, I am here and I'm on duty, and other people can see that I'm on duty. So I think that would probably be the next thing.
I do think he is right when he cancels doing the wedding. I think that was a good boundary for him to put in place, and he needed to find another priest to do it. Well, was it the day before? No.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. It's certainly in the week up to.
Yeah, finding someone else and go, for a number of reasons, I just can't do this blessing. Would you do that instead? I think that was quite a sensible boundary for him to put in place. The way he goes about it and pretends that, you know, there's an illness is awkward. But I did think that was quite a smart thing for him to do that he then doesn't do because he does the wedding anyway. What do you think?
And because of his attraction to the daughter of a couple, I could see, like, if it was he was attracted to the bride or the groom, actual people he was meant to be doing the wedding for, you should not be the one doing the wedding because that is a really awkward situation to be in and you're not the right person. But I don't know. I think there were other boundaries he could have put in place rather than letting that couple down last minute. And actually having a brave conversation with Fleabag saying, look, this happened and we're attracted to each other, but we can't do anything with this. And I need to focus on your dad and new stepmom's wedding. And this is where my focus needs to be.
Yeah.
Like, there needed to be a brave conversation there. He needed to have some people he was being accountable to. Like, so if I started building a close friendship with someone in my parish and I thought, oh, there's something here, I'd probably tell you two, or I'd tell my cell group, Nat and Thomas, and I'd have people who knew what was happening and who could check in with me, and who would be journeying alongside me, making sure that I kept right in my head and in my soul about what was going on. I like your idea, Ross, about when Fleabag comes into a vestry, actually taking it to a more public space. If it was a case of then someone asking to receive confession, or a confession seemed like a good idea, if it was appropriate trying to postpone it to the next day when I'll be more sober, because I've already said I think you need to be in the right, there's certain preparations you need to do to take to actually take formal confession.
But I get why he takes her there to talk it through. Because I do think it's easier to talk about something when you're not, you've not got an eye-to-eye conversation. And that's the whole point of it, isn't it, in many ways? That you are just, alone in a box with someone who, you know, you can't see their reactions and all this kind of stuff.
If he wasn't drunk, I don't think it would have been the way that it did.
Yeah, I think it's probably fair. And one of the things that we see consistently through their friendship is that he gets excited about sharing things that, you know, that he knows because of his job and his spirituality with Fleabag, whether it be, here's a Bible. I don't expect you to read it all, but, you know, give it a chance. Mm. He takes her to a Quaker meeting just, you know, so that she can experience that. And there's a wonderful bit as well where they're talking about death, kind of thing. You know, why believe in? He's got a wonderful line. Why would you believe something awful when you could believe something wonderful?
Yeah.
And you know, like having somebody to share his thoughts with on a different level than a Sunday service over mass. But and again, I think we see that with the confessional. He's like, oh, my friend is wanting to talk about something that is deep in their soul.
Yeah.
The confessional's great for that. You go in there and I'll go in here. And he takes her through, oh, this is what you would say if you were Catholic. And she gives banter back. No, I'm not doing that. And then it works. Because she's there, she has this wonderful monologue about, which I think is deeply human. And I think probably one of the reasons why it is after that outpouring that she... that he sort of comes to her, and there's such a breach in sort of that kind of priestly relationship, is that I think she is speaking what he is feeling, and I think it is a meeting of their two souls in their lonely.
Go on, Ross, read it out.
Shall I read? Do you want to hear it?
You might have to bleep it.
So she says, I want someone to tell me what to wear in the morning. And the priest says, okay, well, I think there are people who can do that. And she says, no, I want someone to tell me what to wear every morning. I want someone to tell me what to eat, what to like, what to hate, what to rage about, what to listen to, what band to like, what to buy tickets for, what to joke about, what not to joke about. I want someone to tell me what to believe in, who to vote for, who to love, and how to tell them. I just think I want someone to tell me how to live my life, Father, because so far I think I've been getting it wrong. And I know that is why people want people like you in their lives, because you just tell them how to do it. You just tell them what to do and what they'll get out of the end of it. And even though I don't believe your bullshit, and I know that scientifically nothing I do makes any difference in the end anyway, I'm still scared. Why am I still scared? Just tell me what to do, Father.
And then he says, Neil.
And his response to her vulnerability is take advantage, which, doesn't she say earlier something like, I don't want to be... And in one of her signs, I don't want to be vulnerable because I don't want you to be able to use that over me or something.
I don't want you to get to know me. Something like that. She says something like that in the Guinea Pig Cafe.
Yeah. Yeah, in the Guinea Pig Cafe. So,
But equally, I think that it speaks into that very human experience of someone who is feeling alone and actually... Why can't someone just swoop in, pick me up and hold me? It's like the name of that musical, Stop the World, I Want to Get Off, kind of thing, of everything is going far too fast. And for Fleabag, her mum is dead, her best friend is dead, she's got this business, her relationships are dysfunctional. And another scene that I think is really probably good for comparison is one with the counsellor. Which is in episode episode two, her dad, as a birthday present, gets her a voucher for a counsellor. And there's some really interesting stuff in there as well. Like, she ends up... It is the counsellor who says that Fleabag is just a girl with no friends and an empty heart, by your own description.
Ouch.
And Fleabag says, I have friends. Counselor, oh, so you do have someone to talk to. Yeah. And then Fleabag winks at the camera. Like, we as the audience are, you know, she sees us as her friends. But then she does come out about having, well, she says that, I want to blank a priest. Catholic? Yes. A good one? Yes. Looks good in the gestures to the dog collar. Mm-hmm. Yes. I understand, says the counsellor. Do you really want to blank the priest, or do you want to blank God? Can you blank God? Oh, yes. Just please tell me how to not blank a priest before I get arrested. And the counsellor says, I don't think blanking a priest will make you feel as powerful as you think it will.
Yeah.
Which I think is a really interesting line. But then there's a whole thing. Then Fleabag says, can you just tell me what to do? And the counsellor says, you know. You already know what you're going to do. Everybody does. And that then comes into a bit of an exchange, which, you know, where Fleabag says, well, what's the point of you then? But, you know, this is this sense of Fleabag going through this series, trying to work out what to do and to find someone to tell her what to do. And sometimes that might be the priest. Sometimes that might be the counsellor. Sometimes that might be her sister or whatever. But...
I think there's lots of big discussions that we've had as part of our episode today, and they're all kind of things that could fall into many different categories. We could go on lots of different tangents. So thanks, Ross, for making me finally watch the end of Fleabag, because I did enjoy it. I thought it was, did enjoy it. I thought it was good, and I understood the ending a lot better now. But I did cringe most of the way through episode four, going, I know what's coming and I don't like it. Please, no. So we've talked a lot about loneliness, about coping mechanisms, about friendship, about rights and wrongs and all these different things as it relates to Fleabag. So I think I'm going to ask all of you listeners to have a little think about, what do you do when you're feeling lonely? You know, if you've got that kind of slight emptiness and loneliness inside, what kind of tactics and coping mechanisms do you go to? And actually, if you're feeling a bit lonely at the moment, why don't you go and use one of the good ones? Go and talk to someone, go and watch something nice and warm and fuzzy on the telly, probably a Hallmark movie, and make sure you're looking after yourself and your friends. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of The Vicars Watch Dibley. Thank you to Nat for editing our ramblings.
Any opinions expressed are our own and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Church of England or any other organisation with which we are affiliated.
If you like our podcast, leave us a review, follow us on social media and share it with your friends. And, as always, bless you for listening.
Not quite a joke today, but I thought we'll go for a cheesy pick-up line for picking up a priest.
Let's see if it works. Okay, so, I'm ready.
Let's see if it works. Hey, baby, I heard God called you. Can I do the same?
Absolutely, you can. Thank you very much.
That's so cute. Oh, my goodness.